Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading from True West Magazine, September-October 2024 edition. The cover story, Killer Kids of the Civil War by Bob Bowes Bell. Close to a half million boys under the age of 18 were involved in both the Union and Confederate forces during the Civil War. Some historians believe as many as 100,000 Union soldiers were 15 years of age or younger. Although statistics are not available for the rebel forces, it is believed the South had a similar proportion of underage soldiers. What is shockingly clear is that the boys who were exposed to the horrors of war in the 4 years of unbridled bloodshed were hardened and trained to be raiders, which, when you think about it, are the prerequisites for supreme education in outlawry after the war. And that is why the fighting, especially in Missouri and Kansas, paved the way for the Western gunfighter that followed as sort of a master's degree from a 4-year college of war. This is that story. After the Battle of Centralia, rebel troops dallied with the dead Union soldiers. According to author T.J. Stiles, the rebels walked among the dead, crushing faces with rifle butts and shoving bayonets through their bodies, pinning them to the ground. Others slid knives out of their sheaths and knelt down to work. One by one, they cut 17 scalps loose, then carefully tied them to their saddles and bridles. At least one guerrilla carved a nose off a victim. Others sliced off ears or sawed off hands and switched their bodies. Someone pulled the trousers off one corpse, cut off the penis, and shoved it in the mouth of the dead man. It was a playground for juvenile atrocities. One 16-year-old bushwhacker was credited with killing the Union commander. The proud killer's name was Jesse James. His older brother Frank, 17, later remembered, "We rode out of the woods, low on our ponies, like Indians. They frolicked like this for some time until their commander, the old man, told them to stop. They called their leader the old man. William Anderson, also known as Bloody Bill, was 23. A teacher's bloody field trips. Born in Ohio, the eldest of 12 children, William Quantrill taught school off and on before turning to raiding in the bloody Kansas corridor of the Civil War. His young charges included future outlaws Jesse and Frank James and Cole Younger, not to mention Bloody Bill Anderson, among others. He taught them all well. His biggest raiding lesson came during the pre-dawn hours of August 21, 1863, when some 450 of Quantrill's raiders rode into Lawrence, Kansas, and slaughtered more than 160 men and boys. Some estimates have the bloody total at 190. They also robbed the bank and looted every home. However, their main target, James Henry Lane, the leader of the Free State Party of Kansas, escaped, barely, in his nightclothes by running through a cornfield and hiding. The School of Hard Knocks. James, 15, confides to a friend that he has seen sights that would make the wickedest hearts sick. Tradition claims James gravitated to General James Lane, organizer of the Free State Army of Kansas. For more than a year, he follows Lane as a scout, and some say as a bodyguard for Lane, as the troops battle against the Missouri border ruffians. All sides perpetrate atrocities, lynchings, massacres, and all the horrors of guerrilla warfare. It is a rough school, and the boys learn their lessons well. And it's off to graduate school. At the end of the Civil War, a generation of boys looked for a reprieve from the fighting. But some of these kids were too well trained to let all those warfare skills go to waste, especially when so many people in Missouri, and throughout most of the South, felt oppressed by the banks and the railroads. With a little nudging, not much, a whole bunch of spunky farm boys began to ply the trade they were trained for: bank robbery and train robbery. Over the course of the next 20 years, a whole bunch of banks and railroads felt the bite, and a whole slew of country outlaws rose to fame and infamy. A couple of them rose damn close to immortality, and you know who that would include. The James Gang by the numbers. Jesse James and Frank James. 24 robberies, 11 banks, 7 trains, 3 stagecoaches, 1 town looted, 1 fairgrounds gate receipts robbery, 1 steamboat robbery, 19-year career of committing crimes, $323,000 estimated dollars stolen. Gang member Doc Miller claimed the actual take was much higher because of underreporting by railroads, $1,038,000. 17. Number of killings. Not all can be attributed to Jesse, but some were done in wartime. 0. Minutes spent behind bars. Jesse was never arrested or captured. 27,000. The estimated number of Missourian deaths from guerrilla violence during the Civil War. 37. Number of movies about Jesse, so far. Do any of these stats change the way we think about Jesse? Not really, because, quote, there are lies, damn lies, and then there are statistics. Old Vaquero saying. On July 21st, 1865, James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, warns Dave Tutt not to pack that watch across the square at noon unless dead men can walk. The square is in Springfield, Missouri, and the watch in question is simply a final push to fight it out man to man. They do, facing off at 100 paces, with Tutt allegedly firing first and missing, while Hickok's shot hits Tutt in the heart, killing him almost instantly. This becomes the prototype for almost every Hollywood gunfight ever filmed. Are you satisfied? James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, allegedly turned on the gathered crowd and said these words to them. The utterance has added meaning because this lone event became the prototype for the stand-up gunfight that became a staple in hundreds of Western movies. An iconic myth is born. Out of all this terror and confusion and guerrilla warfare came a generation of young men who were schooled in the arts of deadly tactics. As they approached manhood, more than a few of them wandered west and encountered a broader and more significant conflict between three pre-existing cultures, indigenous, Spanish, and Mexican. It is little wonder that a mythic story would be born out of the ensuing conflict and that a Caucasian gunfighter would rise out of this turmoil and take his place in the pantheon of worldwide myths. Some historians claim the gunfighter myth ruled from about 1948 to 1973, and that it has since devolved into parody. True West Magazine, September-October 2024 edition. Behind the Eight Ball by Bob Bozbell. March 18, 1882. Morgan Earp versus Frank Stillwell, Pete Spence, and others. A one-night showing of the play Stolen Kisses is being staged at the Turnverein Hall, north of Schlieffen Hall. It has been 2.5 months since Virgil Earp was shot, and after a flurry of posses, raids, charges, and countercharges over the cowboy killings, things are once again quiet in Tombstone. Wyatt agrees to go out with his brother Morgan, even though the previous night, a local, Briggs Goodrich, whose lawyer brother Ben represents many cowboys, warned Wyatt that there are some strangers here that I think are after you. Goodrich also had a message from one cowboy in particular. By the way, John Ringo wanted me to say to you that if any fight came up between you all, he wanted you to understand that he would have nothing to do with it, that he was going to take care of himself, and everybody else could do the same. After the play, Morgan insists on a game of pool. Wyatt joins his younger brother as the two, along with Dan Tipton and Sherm McMasters, drop in at Campbell and Hatch's saloon for a game. 10 minutes before 11 p.m., Morgan walks around the pool table to line up a shot. As he leans over, a pane of glass in the back door explodes as a bullet catches Morgan in the middle of the back, goes through his body, and lodges in the leg of a bystander. As Morgan falls against the table, a second shot is fired through the gaping hole. The bullet thuds against a far wall near the ceiling, just above Wyatt's head. As patrons dive for cover, Morgan slides off the table and collapses in a pool of blood. Perhaps fearing another attack, Wyatt, McMasters, and Tipton lift Morgan and move him about 10 feet away from the rear door and near a door to the card room. Three doctors are summoned, Matthews, Goodfellow, and Miller. After a brief consultation, they pronounce the wound mortal. Morgan's brother and friends then move him into the card room and place him on a lounge as Morgan's other brothers, Virgil, James, and Warren, are summoned, along with Virgil's wife, Allie, and James's wife, Bessie. The epitaph reports, notwithstanding the intensity of this mortal agony, not a word of complaint escaped his lips, and all that was heard, except those whispered into the ears of his brother and known only to him, were, "Don't. I can't stand it. This is the last game of pool I'll ever play." From The Man Who Was There, March 19, 1882. Another assassination last night about 11 o'clock. I heard the shots, two in number, but hearing so many after dark was not particularly startled, though I remarked to Joseph L. Redfern about it. Poor Morgan Earp was shot through by an unknown party, probably two or three in number, in Campbell and Hatch's billboard parlor, while playing pool with Bob Hatch. The shots, two, came through the ground window leading into an alley running to Fremont Street on the east side of Otis and Company store. Geo Berry received the spent ball in his thigh, sustaining a flesh wound. The second shot was fired apparently at Wyatt Earp. Murderers got away, of course, but it was and is quite evident who committed the deed. The man was Stillwell, in all probability. For two cowardly sneaking attempts at murder, this and the other shots at Virgil E., when I came nearly getting a dose, rank in the head. Morg lived about 40 minutes after being shot and died without a murmur. Bad times ahead now. George W. Parsons. What were Morgan's last words to Wyatt? The epitaph noted in the March 20th, 1882 edition that, before he died, Morgan whispered something into his brother Wyatt's ear. Several versions of what he may have said gained popularity over the years. In one, Morgan asks, "Do you know who did it?" And Wyatt responds, "Yes, and I'll get him." "That's all I ask," Morgan whispers. "But Wyatt, be careful." 2 months after the events in Tombstone, Wyatt would say, when they shot him, he said the only thing he regretted was that he wouldn't have a chance to get even. "I told him I'd attend it to hit for him." In the last years of his life, Wyatt allegedly told this version to author Stuart Lake. "I've never told anyone what Morgan said to me then, not even Virgil. Morgan had a boyish curiosity which I never knew to be satisfied. Morg got me to read one of his books, reporting experiences of persons who had visions of heaven when close to death. I told him I thought the yarns were overdrawn, but at his suggestion we promised each other that when the time came for one of us to go, that one would try to leave for the other some actual line on the truth of the book. He was sensitive to the fun others might poke at such notions, so in the last few seconds of his life, when he knew he was going, he asked me to bend close. 'I guess you were right, Wyatt,' he whispered. 'I can't see a damn thing.'" Most historians today think Lake made up the story. Mrs. Marietta Spence drops a bombshell. At the murder inquest on the killing of Morgan Earp, Marietta Spence gave damning testimony against her husband of 8 months. "Reside in Tombstone, and am the wife of Peter Spence. On last Saturday night, the 18th of March, was in my house on Fremont Street. For 2 days, my husband was not home, but in Charleston, but came home about noon on Saturday. He came with two parties, one named Fries, a German, Frederick Bode. I don't know the other's name, believed to be Florentino Cruz. Each had a rifle. They then entered the front room and began to converse with Frank Stillwell. There was an Indian with Stillwell called Charlie, Hank Swilling. He was armed with a pistol and carbine. Both Charlie and Stillwell were armed with pistols and carbines when they returned to the house Saturday night. The conversation between Spence and Stillwell and the others was carried on in a low tone. They appeared to be talking some secret. When they came in, I got out of bed to receive them and noticed they were excited. Why, I don't know. Stillwell came in the house about an hour before Spence and the other two. On Sunday morning, Spence told me to get breakfast about 6 o'clock, which I did. After we had a quarrel, during which he struck me and my mother, and during which he threatened to shoot me, when my mother told him he would have to shoot her too. His expression was that if I said a word about something I knew about, he would kill me, that he was going to Sonora and would leave my dead body behind him. Spence didn't tell me so, but I know he killed Wyatt Earp. I think he did it because he arrived at my house all a tremble, and both the others who came with him. Myself and mother heard the shots, and it was a little after when Stillwell and the Indian, Charlie, came in. I judged they had been doing wrong from the condition, white and trembling, in which they arrived. Marietta also testified that 4 days prior to the murder, her husband had been talking to an Indian as Morgan Earp walked by. Spence nudged the Indian and said, "That's him. That's him." The Indian then started down the street so as to get a good look at him. However, when the case against Spence and the others came up for trial on April 2nd, the defense successfully blocked Marietta's testimony, probably on grounds that wives cannot testify against their husbands. The prosecution quietly dropped the case. A midnight ride. According to Tucson's Arizona Daily Star, Frank Stillwell was spotted in Tucson early on Sunday morning, 6 or 7 hours after the Morgan shooting. This gave him a pretty solid alibi. Some argue that a 70-mile run on horseback is not out of the question. A surprising admission. In spite of the damning accusations by Marietta Spence, Wyatt Earp never believed her husband was involved in Morgan's murder. Late in life, he wrote to author Walter Noble Burns, "I am satisfied that Spence had nothing to do with the assassination of Morgan, although he was against us." Wyatt believed Swilling, Stillwell, and Cruz were joined by John Ringo and Curly Bill Brocious. Aftermath, odds and ends. According to the epitaph, Morgan was shot at 10:50 on Saturday night, and his body was placed in a casket and sent to Colton, California, the Earp's home base. It was guarded to contention by his brothers and two or three of his most intimate friends. The funeral cortege started away from the Cosmopolitan Hotel about 12:30 yesterday, Sunday, March 19th. Many riders have mistakenly assumed that Virgil and his wife accompanied Morgan's body, but they left Tombstone the following day. Pete Spence turned himself in to Sheriff Behan and was allowed to keep a pistol in his cell as protection against a possible attack by the Earps, which never came. Although acquitted in the Morgan Earp murder, Spence later served time in Yuma Territorial Prison for assault. Pardoned after serving a year, Spence, now going by the name E.L. Ferguson, married the widow of Finn Clanton. Recommended reading, Classic Gunfights Volume 2 by Bob Bowes Bell, published by Two Roads West. True West Magazine, September-October 2024 edition. The West is Alive by Johnny D. Boggs and the editors of True West. The nation's top Western art museums provide a window into our past that inspires our present. Art of the American West from old favorites like Frederick Remington and Charlie Russell to today's men and women still attracts fans. Museums and galleries prove that during the past year, with a wide range of artists, new and old. And 2024-25 looks just as good with the opening of the Hobb Family Collection of Western American Art Project, a four-exhibit view that opened in May at the Tacoma, Washington Art Museum. And Imprisoned But Empowered, Cheyenne Warrior Artists from Fort Marion at Oklahoma City's National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, September 13th through January. Here are this year's top 10. 1. Idle George Museum of American Indians and Western Art, Indianapolis, Indiana. Always a favorite and always thinking outside the box, the Idle George amazed with acts of faith, religion, and the American West. A look at how religion shaped and influenced the West, which closed August 4th. But the magically mythical Preston Singletary, Raven, and the Box of Daylight, the tingling American artist story of Raven, the creator trickster in the Tlingit culture, opens November 8th and runs through March 9th. This exhibit was organized by Singletary and the Museum of Glass in Tacoma, Washington. Don't forget the Idle George's annual Indian Market, June 22nd through the 23rd. Online, idlejorg, idlejorg.org. The Museum of Western Art, Kerrville, Texas. The former Cowboy Artists of America Museum continues to showcase all things Western. Case in point, Scott Christensen and Quang Ho, which ends September 21st, displays Western landscapes as seen by Christensen, who grew up in Lander, Wyoming, and whose works have been shown at Russia's Ila Repin St. Petersburg State Academic Institute, and Ho, a Vietnamese-American, who can be realistic or abstract or a bit of both. MuseumOfWesternArt.com. 3. Heard Museum, Phoenix, Arizona. At this premier museum for American Indian artwork and home to the annual Indian Fair and Market, March 1st and 2nd, we recommend Harry Fonseca Transformations, which closes April 20th, and Art and Soul, Sneakers as Art, running through January 5th. As always, home Native people in the Southwest is a must, no matter how many times you've seen it. Online, Heard, HEARD.org. Number 4, the Brenton Museum, Bighorn, Wyoming. Hurry, Wyoming's artist, Harry Jackson, featuring paintings and bronze sculptures, curated by Cody artist Gerald A. Shippen, closes September 2nd. But admirers of Western and American Indian artwork always have plenty to see. Besides the ranch, buildings, and surrounding countryside are works of art. Online, the Brenton, Brinton, museum.org. Number 5, Taos Art Museum, Taos, New Mexico. Taos photographer Zoe Zimmerman has been taking pictures for years, and forsaken objects and untold stories, on display in the museum's Fetchin House till January 12th, showcases Zimmerman's photographs of items found in the house's basement, as well as some Nikolai Fetchin landscapes and portraits. Online, TaosArtMuseum.org. Number 6, Denver Art Museum, Denver, Colorado. We're sad to see the Russells in Denver, 1921, showing his works from a solo art show at the Brown Palace Hotel, close. But Wild Things, the art of Maurice Sendak, opening October 13th, might not be all that Western, but it'll sure give you a smile. And there's plenty to see in the Western American art galleries. Online, denverartmuseum.org. Number 7, Desert Caballeros Western Museum, Wickenburg, Arizona. After Howard Post, Western Perspectives, closed in February, The Horse and Art opened in July and runs through June 8th. And Werner Segarra Vaqueros de la Cruz del Diablo is up September 28th through March 2nd. A longtime favorite, the Cowboy Up exhibition and sale celebrates its 20th anniversary, March 22nd through May 25th. Online, westernmuseum.org. Number 8, the Whitliff Collections, San Marcos, Texas. This unique museum owes a lot to its namesake, Bill Whitliff, of Lonesome Dove miniseries fame. With a focus on Southwestern literature, art, photography, music, and of course, Lonesome Dove. Witness to War, focusing on the United States' 1914 invasion and occupation of Veracruz, closed in July. But Edward Curtis, Treasures of the North American Indian, rotates the renowned photographer's works, and the Lonesome Dove collection is always a fixture. Online, thewhitliffcollections.txst.edu. Number 9, Crocker Art Museum, Sacramento, California. With three stories of art that constantly changes, this museum is always worth visiting. American Indian art has long been exhibited here. Pueblo Pottery, Native American pottery and sculpture, runs through December 3rd, 2028. Online, crockerart.org. Number 10, Panhandle Plains Historical Museum, Canyon, Texas. The PPHM's roughly 8,000 art pieces continue to amaze in galleries dedicated to Western illustrators. Texas Panhandle favorite H.D. Bugby and Dallas Art Society founder Frank Riaw. The art isn't all Western. Dali's Wonderland revealed Salvador Dali's take on Alice's Adventures in Wonderland in a special exhibit earlier this year. Online, panhandleplains.org. Favorite Western Regional Art Museums. Phippen Museum, Prescott, Arizona. The annual Hold Your Horses Invitational Exhibition and Sale runs through September 29th, but there's always something to see in the Phippen's permanent collection, including works by Solon H. Borglum and, of course, its namesake, George Phippen, 1955 to 1966. Co-founder and first president of the Cowboy Artists of America. Online, Phippen, Phippen, artmuseum.org. Legacy Gallery, Scottsdale, Arizona. A who's who of great Western artists can be found in this must-see Scottsdale Gallery, including Rick Terry's offbeat looks at the West, Scott Rogers' detailed sculptures, and wonderful paintings by Tom Browning, Grant Redden, and others. Online, legacygallery.com. Tucson Museum of Art, Tucson, Arizona. The museum covers just about every kind of art imaginable. Popol Vuh and the Maya Art of Storytelling closes September 22nd, but visitors can spend hours admiring the ongoing Southwest art, contemporary conversations, Art of the American West, and People of the West, A Rethinking of Westerners. Online, TucsonMuseumOfArt.org. Olaf White Horse Museum, El Cajon, California. Olaf Weighorst's story remains inspirational. Danish kid, not out of his teens, arrives in America in 1918, broke, and knowing three English words. Joins the army, then becomes a cowboy. Teaches himself to paint, and becomes one of the wealthiest painters of his time. Online, Weighorst, Weighorst, museum.org. A.R. Mitchell Museum of Western Art, Trinidad, Colorado. Don't think this museum is solely dedicated to its namesake, whose works adorn the covers of myriad magazines back in that golden era. You'll also find works from noted illustrators Harvey Dunn and Harold von Schmidt, and even Native American pieces that Mitchell collected and also Hispanic colonial art. Online, armitchellmuseum.org. Stark Museum of Art, Orange, Texas. Black Pioneers, Legacy in the American West, which told Black Western history through pictorial quilts, closed in August, but with a gallery that includes artwork by John James Audubon, Georgia O'Keeffe, Frederick Remington, and Charlie Russell. There's plenty to see. Online, starkmuseum.org. Yellowstone Art Museum, Billings, Montana. Emphasizing artists and art from Montana and the Northwest, YAM, Y-A-M, continues to impress, celebrating complexities, a U-Cross Native American Fellowship artists, featuring works from four Native nations with different styles and backgrounds, whose works include painting, photography, printmaking, and sculpture, runs through October 6th. Online, artmuseum.org. Jocelyn Art Museum, Omaha, Nebraska. The moment we've been waiting for arrived September 10th, when the Jocelyn, which first opened its doors in 1931, reopens after 2 years of reconstruction and renovation. We can't wait to see how the museum will display its outstanding permanent collection, new works, and a stunning new building. Online, Jocelyn, JOSLYN.org. Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Visiting this museum always feels intimate. Rooted in Place, which focused on O'Keeffe's fascination with trees, ended in August, but the phenomenal Georgia O'Keeffe, Making a Life, which focuses on how she lived or curated her own life, runs through November 2nd, 2025. Online, O'Keeffe, museum.org. New Mexico Museum of Art, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Selections from the 20th Century Collection runs through the end of this year at this museum just off the plaza, while contemporary art fans will admire off-center New Mexico art 1970 to 2000 through May 4th at the museum's Vladim Contemporary in Santa Fe's Rail Yard Arts District, about a 15-minute walk from the plaza. Online, nmartmuseum.org. Chisholm Trail Heritage Museum, Cuero, Texas. Known for its extraordinary collection of spurs and Edward S. Curtis photogravures, this museum, about 90 miles southeast of San Antonio, amazed art lovers with spectacular stitches, works by master textile artists from the Frank Klein Collection, which closed February 10th. Online, ChisholmTrailMuseum.org. Kennedy Ranch Museum, Sarita, Texas. It was once was the Kennedy Pasture Company building. The story of Mifflin Kennedy and his family, three generations worth, is told in a grand building through murals and Kim Crowsley sculptures. And the surrounding Wild Horse Desert is beautiful, too. Online, Kennedy, KENEDY.org. Nelson Museum of the West, Cheyenne, Wyoming. An old favorite, the Nelson tells the story of many Western cultures through artifacts, books, and art, from custom saddles to homemade spurs to many paintings, even painter Bert Proctor's studio, to Native works, to a humorous Bud Odell wood carving. Online, NelsonMuseum.org. Hewlett Museum and Art Gallery, Hewlett, Wyoming. Specializing in Eastern Wyoming's history and culture, this small museum often tells its story through art and its art through history. Quilt lovers shouldn't miss the Hewlett's fourth annual quilt show, September 20th through the 22nd. Online, HewlettMuseum.org. Johnny D. Boggs has been writing about art for more than 25 years, or basically, since he moved to Art Mecca, Santa Fe, New Mexico. True West Magazine, September-October 2024 edition. A Floating Feast by Sherry Monahan. the Mississippi River Steamboat lines fetid passengers with gourmet menus while ferrying them up and down the Great Riverway. Dining options on the frontier included all the usual places, like restaurants, hotels, around a campfire, or other traditional locales. However, dining on moving transportation like riverboats was a different experience. Before the Transcontinental Railroad was completed in 1869, people traversed the rivers and waterways to head west and visit various locations. Mark Twain worked his way up to pilot a Mississippi riverboat he dubbed an Ancient Tub. He recalled a trip to St. Louis on the Paul Jones. She was not a creature to attract the eye of wiser travelers. While working as an upstream steersman, they pulled into St. Louis, where a large New Orleans boat was docked. He and his chief went aboard, and Twain was impressed. "She was a grand affair. I wondered how I could have ever considered the little Paul Jones a large craft." He went on to say that the white apron Texas tenders brought up tarts, ices, and coffees during the mid-watch, day and night, to the pilot house. He wrote, "She was as clean and as dainty as a drawing room. When I looked down her long, gilded saloon, it was like gazing through a splendid tunnel. The bar was marvelous, and the barkeeper had been barbered and upholstered at incredible cost." Cookhouses were the boat's kitchens, the center of social life, and the source for all the news on the boat. Rumors were branded cookhouse talk, which meant something was about to happen. An old custom of steamboat men having coffee promptly at 4 o'clock that started on ocean vessels continued on the Mississippi River boats. The captains were often heard asking, "Have you had your coffee?" Steamboat coffee was different than the coffee served on land. It was taken black because it wasn't practical to carry cows on board. They drank it from great ironstone cups, which held about a quart, and they said it helped keep malaria away. Menus on these great ships included items often found in restaurants and hotels. An 1866 dinner menu from the steamer St. Charles included over 100 items, from soup to nuts. Some of the offerings were oyster soup, salmon a la Victoria, haddock a la Royal, boiled sugar-cured ham and leg of mutton, roasted ribs of beef, venison, turkey, chicken, pork, and veal. Cold dishes included duck, chicken, sardine, lobster, oyster, and ham a la St. Charles salads. Passengers chose from 17 hot side dishes, some of which were breast of lamb, macaroni with cream, sweetbreads, giblets, flank steaks, rabbit, pork, and kraut, German style. Desserts included coconut, mints, lemon, peach and blackberry pies, jelly, caraway, fruit and lady cakes, ice cream, and a variety of candies. Many of the chefs who ran frontier kitchens had worked on riverboats. Alvin Snow Young was one of them, and was hired as a chef by Aristotle Petro, who owned the Occidental Chop House in Tombstone, Arizona. Young was an experienced Mississippi River steamboat cook, which, according to the epitaph, was sufficient guarantee of his culinary skills. This is one of the many pastries served on these ships. Blackberry pie. Ingredients: 1.5 cups flour, 1 cup butter, cut into pieces, 1/2 cup water, 2 to 3 cups blackberries, 2 to 3 tablespoons sugar. Rub the butter into the flour and then add the sugar and the water. Mix well until the dough comes together. Roll it out and fold it over. Do this 3 times. Divide the dough in half and chill for 1 hour. Roll out the dough for a bottom and top crust to about 1/4 inch. Place crust in the pie pan and place the berries on it and sprinkle with sugar. Cover the second crust and press a fork around the edges to seal and make a pattern. Sprinkle additional sugar over the top of the crust and bake at 375 degrees for 25 to 30 minutes until golden. Recipe adapted from the Alaska Yukon Pacific Exposition Souvenir Cookbook, 1909. True West Magazine, September-October 2024 edition. The Biggest Leg in Mexico by Jana Bommersbach. Nobody messed with Sarah Bowman, the Great Western. She was a giant among women. Hell, she was a giant among most men. This Amazon of the border, who was a military hero in the Mexican War, a groundbreaking businesswoman, a good specimen of the frontier woman, and as some put it, the prototype for the whore with a heart of gold. They called Sarah Bowman the Great Western, borrowing the name of the world's largest steamship. It fit the woman who was at least 6 feet tall, maybe 6'2", and weighed over 200 pounds, had enormous breasts, and an hourglass figure. The nickname was applied because of her size, but it stuck because of her grit. This was a woman of uncommon courage and determination who didn't, frankly, take guff from no one. She was born Sarah Knight in 1812 or 1813 in Tennessee or Missouri. She was never clear about her early days. She also used the surname Borgenis and Borget. Along the way, she accumulated several husbands, not always with the benefit of clergy, which spoke to both her nature and the necessity of the times, and came into her own as she traveled with General Zachary Taylor's army in the Mexican War from 1846 to 1848. She had a sense of self-assurance that stunned both men and women. One historian noted she had a reputation of being something of the roughest fighter on the Rio Grande and was approached in a polite, if not humble, manner. And woe to those who didn't understand that, as shown in the following story recounted in an article by Mercedes Graff in Minerva Quarterly Report on Women in the Military. One day a trooper let out a wolf whistle and muttered under his breath as Sarah walked by. The Amazon whirled with the litheness of a panther. Before the startled heckler knew what was happening, she had hoisted him like a sack of feathers and pinned him. Effortlessly, she held him there with one hand, her grayish-green eyes boring straight into his. Finally, the astonished soldier found his tongue. He apologized. Suddenly, she dropped her hand, and the unhappy trooper plummeted back to earth. The woman turned abruptly and stalked away. She had not uttered a single word during the entire incident. What drew her to the Mexican War was never explained, but drawn she was. It was honorable in those days for wives of enlisted men to become camp followers, before that phrase was dirtied to mean loose women. The wives enrolled in the army as cooks, laundresses, nurses, and seamstresses. The most famous camp follower was Lady Washington, who spent most of the Revolutionary War camped with her husband, General George Washington. Sarah did all those jobs and more, sometimes picking up a weapon, often using her strength to drag or carry men off the battlefield. A history project from the University of Texas at Austin reports that Sarah first distinguished herself as a fighter in March 1846 at the crossing of the Arroyo Colorado, when she offered to wade the river and whip the enemy single-handedly if General William Jenkins Worth would lend her a stout pair of tongs. 2 months later, during the bombardment of Fort Brown, she refused to seek safety with the other women and continued to operate the officers' mess for a week while under siege. She didn't even stop when a tray was shot from her hands or when a shell fragment pierced her sunbonnet. Her fearlessness during the siege earned her another nickname, the Heroine of Fort Brown, the University's Handbook of Texas notes. At a celebratory dinner after the battle, a special toast was offered for her, reports Graff in Minerva, to the Great Western, one of the bravest and most patriotic soldiers at the Siege of Brown. During the Battle of Buena Vista, she distinguished herself again by loading cartridges, and carrying wounded soldiers to safety from the battlefield. Sarah was acclaimed in General Zachary Taylor's army from the highest general to the lowliest drummer boy for her consistent courage in the front line of battle, Graff notes. Sarah went to Mexico with the army, opened a hotel in Saltillo that provided drink and women, and stayed until after the war. But in July 1848, she wanted to accompany the army to California. Her husband was gone by then, and only married women were allowed to travel with the army. In a scene that sounds straight out of Hollywood, she rode along the line of men yelling, "Who wants a wife with $15,000 and the biggest leg in Mexico? Come, my beauties, don't all speak at once. Who is the lucky man?" A dragoon named Davis finally stepped forward, and the Great Western was marching with the army yet again. She landed in El Paso, where she became the first female in the town to run a business. Her hotel and restaurant, she reportedly was an incredible cook, catered to gold diggers on the way to California, who stopped for room, board, and entertainment. Historians allude to her as a madam, but give no real details on her hotel brothels, except to report that business was good and nobody had anything but kind words for her. One biographer insists she operated only one brothel and that all the rest of her businesses were legitimate hotels and restaurants. Others note she was a prostitute now and then to support herself, but hasten to add that hardly defined her life. Eventually, she married a German upholsterer named Albert J. Bowman, and they settled in Fort Yuma in the Arizona Territory. Sarah opened yet another restaurant and made a real home in Yuma. She couldn't have children, but she adopted several orphans, some of whom may have been Mexican. A tarantula bite killed her. She was buried with full military honors in the Fort Yuma Post Cemetery on December 23, 1866, reportedly the only woman to be so honored. In 1890, the Department of Army exhumed 159 bodies from that resting place and moved them to the National Cemetery at the Presidio in San Francisco. Sarah Bowman, the Great Western, was among them. Her legend lives to this day. A recent historical novel by Lucia St. Clair Robson is appropriately titled Fearless, a novel of Sarah Bowman. The author tells True West she used the Great Western as her heroine because I was intrigued by a woman who could cold cock a man and inform him he was a son of a bitch as he went down. Somewhere, you can bet, Sarah Bowman is smiling. Did you know? Army wives, whether they traveled with the soldiers or stayed behind in established forts, had to be made of stern stuff. It's reported that Libby Custer was particularly strong. Judy Alter's Extraordinary Women of the America West reports, when word was brought to her of Custer's death at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, she threw a wrap over her dressing gown and accompanied the captain to the 25 other widows of that battle to offer their consolation. True West Magazine, September-October 2024 edition. Durango, Colorado, by Peter Corbett. October's cowboy gathering rounds up poets, pickers, and train lovers. Durango is an active four-season town. Each year starts with winter sports, skiing, snowboarding, snowshoeing, and cross-country skiing at Purgatory Resort, which also has 75 miles of snowmobile trails. Fat biking on wide tire bicycles is also popular on snowy trails in and around Durango. Winter gives way to the Bluegrass Meltdown in April, and then the Iron Horse Bicycle Classic in late spring. Cyclists race 50 miles on US 550 to beat the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad on its run between the two towns. The Scenic Railroad is Durango's most popular year-round attraction, and summer is its busiest season. In fact, Durango, at an elevation of 6,500 feet, is an ideal summer hub for a pack of outdoor adventures: hiking, mountain biking, riding horses, kayaking the Animas River, or exploring nearby Mesa Verde National Park. As the season changes, the San Juan Mountains are brilliant with fall colors and aspen leaves turning golden by mid-September and well into October. Fall is also time for kicking it at the 36th annual Durango Cowboy Gathering. "We are the oldest gathering in Colorado," said Sue McWilliams, president of the Durango Cowboy Gathering. It was previously tagged the Cowboy Poetry Gathering. Elko, Nevada held the first Cowboy Poetry Gathering in 1985. Durango hatmaker Kevin O'Farrell attended and suggested that Durango put on its own Cowboy Poetry Festival. It launched in 1988, McWilliams said. Now it's grown to more than 30 events over 5 days. Western musicians and cowboy poets entertain mostly at indoor venues from October 2nd through 6th. This year's musical lineup includes Kristen Harris and Haley Sandoz, two Texans with their own brand of Western swing music. Local favorites, the Bardi Wranglers, will get the boot-tapping music started for the Cowboy Gathering. Poetry and storytelling events include chuck wagon tales, cowboy lore, and stories of the range. The DNSNGR also has a special cowboy poetry and music train that entertains passengers on the trip to Silverton and back. The big event, October 5th, is a horse-drawn parade along Main Avenue. This year, it will be preceded by a 2-hour horseback social, allowing cowgirls and cowboys to gather, ride, and socialize along 6 blocks of downtown. Children ages 12 and younger will also have a chance to ride horses under the supervision of professional wranglers. The parade attracted an estimated 6,800 people in 2023, and this year's event could bring 10,000 people to downtown, McWilliams said. Event organizers keep their fingers crossed for good parade weather. "Some years it's beautiful, and at that time of year, the leaf colors are gorgeous," she said. "Sometimes it's 70 degrees, and sometimes it's snowing." Al Harper, DNSNGR owner and CEO, said riders on the Scenic Railroad have to be prepared for fast-changing weather on the run to Silverton. "It's funny that first couple of weeks of September to about the third week of October. You can have summer, fall, and winter all in one ride," he said. "At the lower altitude, it's still summer. Then you start to see the beautiful leaves and aspens as you get to 8,500 feet. Then you get to 9,500 feet in Silverton, and the leaves are gone, and you might have snow flurries." The steam train run from Durango to Silverton is seasonal. This year's schedule was from May 6th to October 26th. Heavy snowfall makes it risky to run in the winter. In fact, the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reported on an ill-fated trip stalled by a snowslide 4 miles south of Silverton on February 12, 1947. The train crew handed shovels to Mr. and Mrs. Wallace Lombard, the trip's only passengers, to help them shovel out the locomotive. It took 9 hours. The train never made it to Silverton and returned to Durango, arriving at 3:30 a.m. The newspaper told its readers the Lombards were refunded the money they had paid for tickets. Of course, a light snowfall would enhance the popular Polar Express train that runs from November 22nd to January 1st. The DNSNGR also has a Cascade Canyon winter train with heated coaches. It runs on select days from November to May and covers 26 miles, halfway to Silverton. Imagine stunning scenes of the steam locomotive plume against a backdrop of snow-flocked trees in the mountains. "The Cascade train is also spectacular during spring snowmelt," said Rachel Welsh of Discover Durango. "It's really beautiful because it's when the waterfalls are really flowing." Where history meets the highway. First stop, Visitor Information Center, 802 Main Avenue, Durango.org. Bone up on Iron Horse history. The Roundhouse Museum tells the tales of the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad with roots going back to 1882. It's free. 479 Main Avenue, DurangoTrain.com. A Buckin' Good Bar. The Wild Horse Saloon is a dance hall and bar with live country and southern rock music, plus a badass bouncer named Miss Tammy. 601 East 2nd Avenue, Durango, WildHorseSaloon.com. Read up on Durango. Maria's Bookshop has close to 40,000 books on its shelves in a century-old building. This locally owned independent bookstore is celebrating 40 years in business. 960 Main Avenue. Maria'sBookshop.com. Book a grand historic hotel. Don't stay in a bunkhouse. If you can swing it, stay in the grandeur of the 1887 Strader Hotel with its Diamond Bell Saloon. 699 Main Avenue. Strader.com.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.